information. And everything, until I say so, everything is Euclidean signature. We're going to do the whole thing, Euclidean signature, and then we will put in the Calkins chain for Lorentzian signature. I'm going to review the basic definitions, talk about the constraints and their algebra, talk about equations of motion, and maybe two kinds of solutions you can easily see. Depending on your interest, maybe a couple more solutions. This is all classical. And in particular, I'll come back to something from the beginning, which is sitter, because now we can understand that what I did the first day much better. Then I'm going to talk about boundaries, and I hope this is all we'll get in today. And boundary terms, etc. Okay, so that's the plan today. And then finally, next week, which is also Wednesday, we do the quantization. Okay. So we started with the Palatini action, which, just let me remind you, was we had the frame fields, the alpha wedge, E beta wedge, F gamma delta of omega, epsilon alpha beta gamma delta, minus, if I remember right, 2 lambda determinant of E. One thing I learned, I saw the historian John Satchel yesterday, who's visited here a couple of times, and he told me that actually the first person who wrote down the Palatini variation principle was Einstein in one of his early papers about unified field theory. So it's actually the Einstein variation principle. And I asked him for a reference, I don't have a reference. And by a set of definitions, we split omega into a plus and a minus. I'm just being schematic. We took E wedge E plus, and we're making a 3 plus 1 decomposition. So this is time, this is some spatial slice sigma. We take E plus E wedge E, E is the frame field. We take E wedge E, the self dual part, pull it back to the spatial manifold sigma, and that's a 2 form value in SU2, which is called EABI. And we can raise the index of that, so we can write EA as epsilon ABC EBCI 1/2, or sometimes we just call that EI AB dual. And the discovery of Sen and Ashtekar is that the Einstein's equations can be expressed in a canonical formulation, just in terms of A plus and E. And that's what we did last time. So an A plus also has an SU2 left index. There was a problem with naming these indices last time, but I think just to start fresh, since we're just going to be Hamiltonian, in this lecture, I won't write the bars under just ijk's, are 1, 2, 3, and they're in SU2, the left-hand SU2. And ABCs are spatial indices in sigma. Okay. And because for at least, oh, there's something I wanted to put in. Somewhere in here, we're going to put in the Artem-Laurent approach. But until we get there, we're just going to be forgetting about A minus. So when I say A, that will be shorthand for A plus. I'm not going to keep writing the pluses because the only connection variable that I'm going to be dealing with is the SU2 left connection variable. And then by a series of manipulations, we found that the action could be written in this Kaposi-Adel-Jacobson form of F wedge F IJ, the inverse of some matrix of scalar fields phi ij, where phi is symmetric, and its trace is related to the cosmological constant. And don't trust me on science and so forth. I believe the right factors are in the paper that, yes, all of this is the paper quantum gravity with the possible cosmological constant. And I believe the factors in that paper are right, at least. I worked hard to make them right. Okay. So, and what we argued is that on solutions which are non-degenerate, which means that the determinant of E is not zero, which you can also show is the determinant of the vector field EAI, which is a 3x3 matrix, the free vector field, is not zero, that the solutions to S Kaposi-Adel-Jacobson are equivalent to the solutions to S, I'll call it Palatini because everybody does, which are equivalent to the solutions to S Einstein-Hilbert. So on the solutions which are everywhere non-degenerate, this is a formulation of general relativity. And then what we did last time is we decomposed this action. And we found the following Hamiltonian formulation. So we found the basic Poisson bracket is A with E. And I don't always put a tilde over my vector densities, but many people do always put a tilde over the vector densities to remind us that they're vector densities. So this is delta 3 x y, where you put a tilde because that's a vector density, that's a density on y, delta a b delta I j. And then the action is transformed into Hamiltonian form. So it's the integral dt, the integral on the free manifold of E A dot minus a series of constraints. And so there are constraints lambda I times GI, where that's the Gauss's law, some constraints BA, GA, and I. Oh, yes, there's a notation issue here. So I'll write that as just capital D minus N times C, where these are the constraints you find. G, which we dealt with before, is Gauss's law. D is EA, E, EI, FI, AB. And C is, let me see the formula I'm going to write again. EA, I, EB, J, epsilon, I, J, K, times FAB, K, plus lambda, I believe it's lambda over 3, epsilon, ABC, EC, K. Is the Hamiltonian constraint. So, what we did last time is we turned the Hamiltonian crank, and we, starting with this Kappa Diabel-Jacobson action, we found these constraints. And then by the general theory of constrained systems, that action principle is equivalent to this action principle, where there are 7 Lagrange multipliers, 3 lambdas, which are valued in the SU2 left, VA, which is a vector field on the spatial manifold, and N, which is a scalar inverse density, because this guy here has density weight 2, which is a fact that we'll make use of as we get there. That will be, when we get into the reason why I'm stressing the density weights so much is that when we get to the quantum theory, there's several key technicalities of quantum theory that depend on understanding who is a density and who is not. Okay? So, now what we want to do is study the algebra of these constraints. That's the first thing we want to do. Because if you remember, the Dirac procedure said that you want to discover whether the constraints are preserved by the Hamiltonian. And so this object here is the Hamiltonian. If you like, it's the integral of space, integral dt, of, I'll call it little h tilde, a Hamiltonian density. And the Hamiltonian is the integral on the spatial manifold of this Hamiltonian density. And we need to check that each of the constraints are conserved under evolution by this Hamiltonian. Because the picture is that because there is gauge symmetry, there are 3 Lagrange multipliers in the Hamiltonian. And we'll come back to their interpretation in a little while. But the first thing that we have to check is that all of these are preserved by the Hamiltonian. And because the Hamiltonian is itself a linear combination of these functions, the constraints, then, and because the constraints vanish on the constraint surface. So just to remind you, the picture is that there's some phase space, gamma, which consists of all the functions E and A. This is phase space. That's space-time over there. And there's some surface in the phase space, which is all the constraints vanishing. G equals D equals C equals 0. And consistent evolution, as in the examples that we talked about previously, means that we start on the constraint surface and we evolve remaining in the constraint surface. And that will happen when the time derivative of any of the constraints vanish on the constraint surface. And that will happen if the time derivative of any of the constraints is proportional to constraints. So, roughly speaking, what I have to show is that the time derivative of any of these constraints, which is their Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian, is itself proportional to constraints. And then, since on the constrained surface, those vanish, you get zero. So this is the consistency check. And that will be sufficient if the Poisson brackets of a constraint, of any constraint with any constraint, is a linear combination of constraints. Possibly multiplied by functions. Because on the constraint surface, the constraints vanish. So you could have functions here. Okay. So does everybody see that? As long as, because the Poisson bracket of the constraint with the Hamiltonian becomes the Poisson bracket of the constraints with other constraints, if the result of the Poisson brackets of constraints with constraints is proportional to constraints, possibly times functions on the phase space, then as long as you're on the constraint surface, you get zero, and the constraints therefore are preserved. If they start zero, they stay zero. So this is what we have to check.
Were there terms in the Hamiltonian that were not proportional to constraints?
No. And for the reason that, I mean, I want to go into this later, but for the reason that we saw in the Barber-Bertoni model in one of the early classes, when there's a time-loop parameterization invariance, the Hamiltonian is proportional to constraints, in particular the Hamiltonian constraint. But I have to establish, I mean, I did not sketch that. I did not do the complete transformation from that to this. I sketched it, but you can go back and fill in all the steps and show that this variational principle was equivalent to that variational principle. I mean, this is what I showed under the conditions on 5, this is it. Okay. Just some nomenclature, by the way. So when this is true, if the functions are constants, we say that the algebra is first class. If they're really functions, we say that the algebra is business class. And otherwise, we say that the algebra is second class. Okay. Second class means that the Poisson brackets of constraints are not constraints, but are just some other functions or numbers. Okay. And except for the modern update, this is Dirac's notation. And the business class issue, you'll see why it's an issue. Okay, so we've already discussed, one more thing. It's always convenient, as I've emphasized, to talk about the integrated constraints. So we're really going to be interested in g of lambda, which is the integral of lambda against g. All these integrals I can just write because this is a density of wave one, so it integrates against just some functions, lambda I, g, I. D of b is the integral b a dA, where b is a vector field. And C of n is the integral of n, which is the inverse density C. All these integrals are the manifold. Now, by the way, when we come to put on boundaries, there will be the possibility of a non-zero term here connected to the boundary. But I want to postpone that and do this. Okay. So we already, I believe sometime in the past, computed g of lambda Poisson bracket g of omega, and found that this was g of basically the epsilon ijk lambda j omega k. That is the, you can also write that as g, sort of using notation, a cross product, lambda cross omega. And this is to say that the g's generate a local SU2 algebra. There is an SU2 algebra at each point. A local way of writing this is a g of s, g of y, ij is delta 3 xy epsilon ijk gk of x. But this form, the integrated form, is more precise. And one reason to worry is that an occurrence of importance in field theories is that sometimes the classical constraint algebra pick up quantum corrections. And sometimes those quantum corrections are just proportional to numbers. And they demote the algebra from first class to second class. That's called the problem of anomalies. And there are subtleties about calculations in those contexts. And several, not all of them, but several of those subtleties are easier to deal with if you deal with the integrated objects. And we'll see that as we go along. Okay, so this is SU2. We have also, we did this in the context, I think, of Yang-Mills theory, 2 plus 1 gravity. But let me just repeat that delta lambda, let me say how the fields transform, which was the Poisson bracket of A with G of lambda. And this is A at a point. And it's well defined. It's a Poisson bracket of the field at a point with the integrated constraint. And this is del A lambda I. So it is indeed the gauge transformation. This evaluated the point x, the gauge transformation of A. And similarly, delta lambda E, the same thing, E g of lambda, is epsilon I j k lambda j E a k, again at a point x. So E rotates homogeneously. Lambda is a function valued in the Lie algebra, so it varies. So this is a local gauge transformation, and A transforms like a connection. And the point of view that we take when we study the Hamiltonian theory classically and quantum mechanically is that the transformation properties of fields are consequences of their Poisson brackets with constraints. That is, we don't think, oh, we know that this is a gauge field, and therefore we know that the theory is embedded in these gauge transformations. We say there's some first-class constraints. They are in the Hamiltonian with Lagrange multipliers. Therefore, there's an ambiguity in the evolution, because you can make lambda functions of space, and you could also make it a function of time, but it doesn't affect the evolution, the physical evolution, and I'll come back to exactly what I mean by that, and that consequently these are transformations, these gauge transformations arise from their Poisson brackets with the constraints, and the fact that these should not be physically meaningful comes from the fact that these parameters in the Hamiltonian are undetermined by anything. Lagrangian multipliers are not determined by equations of motion, and therefore free. And if, and so one can put on the requirement, and Dirac put on the requirement, that that physical quantities should not depend on arbitrary Lagrangian multipliers in the Hamiltonian variational principle. And because they do appear, then you have to conclude that some quantities are unphysical, that is, you can't measure these, you hypothesize, and you have to calculate gauge invariant quantities that you can measure. I sort of walk backwards into that. So maybe a little bit later I'll come back and walk forward into that. But the point is that it's not that we tell the theory what the gauge transformations are. The dynamics of the theory tells us what the gauge transformations are. By the theory explicitly, in solving the Hamiltonian form of the theory, you discover what the free Lagrange multipliers are, and then you discover the concept of gauge from the physically meaningful, from the physically sensible requirement that if evolution is deterministic, that the evolution can't depend on undetermined arbitrary functions. So you discover the concept of gauge invariance, and so on. Okay, I'll go back. That's such an important point, I'll go back to it. But let me continue with the going through the properties of these things. Okay, so what is this object? We've talked about this. This seems like it generates ordinary SU2 gauge transformations. What's this? Okay. Well, let's calculate. Okay. So let's ask, what is the variation determined by, parameterized by the vector field V of our fields? Let's start with A. And by that, I mean the Poisson bracket of A with the constraint D of V. So I'm not going to do the details of the calculation, but it's not too hard to see what happens. The A commutes with the F, which is more A's. The A doesn't commute with the E, so the E gets stripped off. So this becomes VB, FABI at X. So what is that? Well, I mentioned this before. There's a cute little thing. Let me start to write it out. That's VB del A ABI minus VB del B AI. And then there's the commutator term VB AA J ABK epsilon I JK. And I'll let you check this. If you stare at this long enough, see this, and actually my sign is backwards of the nice version, but that's okay. In fact, let's think about that. Doesn't matter. This starts to look like a Lie derivative of A by the vector field V. But there's another term in the Lie derivative. The Lie derivative of a one form, let me just write it back to the algebra indices, of V is V, V, del V, AA plus AA, AB, del V, V, V. So I can get minus LD of A, starting with here and exchanging who the derivative acts on here, which means that I have left over a piece that looks like del A of VB of V contracted with A, like that. And then I have this piece, which covariantizes that, if you stare at that, and makes that covariant derivative. You're welcome, this is...
No, I didn't know this.
Yeah, this is after part formulation, so you're welcome to... So, so what this object is the Lie derivative of the gauge field by the vector field minus another term. But we recognize this other term as just the ordinary gauge transformation property of the field. That is, this looks like a term in the Lie derivative of VA minus delta of some lambda of A, the gauge transformation, where lambda, the guy living in the Lie algebra of SU2, is made up of the vector field and the gauge field itself. So what this is a combination of an ordinary gauge transformation and a diffeomorphism. Because a diffeomorphism takes one form fields and moves them around by a Lie derivative. So what this tells us is that I can define another object called D prime A, which is the dA, and I don't trust me on the sign here, but I'll say it's plus AAI dI. So plus it's the d plus a certain amount of the Gauss's law, where I use the gauge field itself to turn the Lie algebra SU2 index into a one-form index. And then the delta prime V of A given by the Poisson bracket of A with this D prime is just the Lie derivative. I'll put a minus sign there to fix that. And don't trust me on this sign. It's just the Lie derivative of A by V. So in other words, since we know that the Gauss's law generates a gauge transformation, this constraint D generates a combination of gauge transformations, that is, ordinary SU2 gauge transformations, and diffeomorphisms on the manifold. So we can just correct it slightly and get a guy that just, we know, purely generates diffeomorphisms of the spatial manifold. Okay. Since the constraints on the constraint surface are zero, so are linear combinations of the constraints on the constraint surface. So nothing prevents me from putting, just mixing in some linear combination of G here and calling this D prime. Okay, and I'll do that much of the time. Then you can also check, so this is a check for you, that if you now take the conjugate electric fields and you compute their transformation under D prime, that this is also the Lie derivative of the vector density. So this constraint, or I should say rather, this constraint corrected by this amount of Gauss's law just generates diffeomorphisms on the spatial manifold. So given a vector field on the spatial manifold, it generates a diffeomorphism. And the effect now, you know, now it follows that the Poisson bracket of any function, I don't know what to call it, any function of E and A, Poisson bracket with D prime of V, is the Lie derivative with respect to the vector field of that function. So this constraint generates diffeomorphisms. So we learn that the theory has a gauge symmetry, which is diffeomorphism to the spatial manifold. Now again, that's not surprising, because we started with an action which was diffeomorphism invariant under the whole space-time manifold. We transformed it to another action which is diffeomorphism invariant under the whole space-time manifold, given a slicing of space-time into evolving slices. Okay, there is a subgroup of the diffeomorphism space-time manifold which just generates diffeomorphisms of the spatial slicings. And we find that there are some constraints that generate those diffeomorphisms.
But does it depend on the kind of slicing you choose, or is slicing independent?
Well, the definition, if you go back, this was before you came in, but just to say, because it's a very important point, the definition of the field E depends on, the field E is the pullback onto the spatial slices of a space-time two-form. So the particular field E that you have depends on the slicings. And similarly, the field A, the vector field, is the pullback into the spatial manifold of a vector field, of a one-form on the space-time. Okay. Now, given this, we can work backwards. And what I mean by this is that every object transforms under the Lie determiner of V by the appropriate formula for the object of its kind. So one form transforms like one forms. Things we know of is vector densities transform like vector densities, densities transform like densities, and so forth. So given this, it's straightforward to work out the algebra of D prime with D prime. So if I take D prime at a point A, at a point X, and I'll just leave that index 3, because that's the kind of thing we're doing, with D prime smeared with some vector field V, we know what this is. This object is a one-form. And therefore, this is the appropriate Lie bracket of V with D prime A as a one-form. At the point X. Now, supposing I smear that. So now I want to consider D. I'm going to integrate that D3x times some other vector field W A of x. So after I've integrated this on x against the vector field W of x, I have the same thing as the Poisson bracket of D prime of W with D prime of V. But I've done the calculation. These functions like V and W are not, I forgot to say this in case it's confusing, they're not dynamical fields, they're free functions in the algebra, and therefore they have vanished the Poisson bracket with everything. So this just goes right through. So this is the integral of on the manifold of WA of LV D prime A of X, and this is now an integral of the manifold. I forgot to say this time, but I've said before, we're dealing with manifolds which are compact. because I have to put a boundary condition on. So I can integrate by parts, and it's something you can check, or maybe you know, that you can integrate Lie derivatives by parts for free, and they become Lie derivatives. So this is the integral with the minus sign of LB on W of D times A and X. But that's just D prime smeared against the vector field LB of W, which is the same thing as D prime smeared against the commutator of D and W with some minus signs. So this tells us, let me just summarize, I'll summarize down here, that D prime of W, D prime of V, is just D prime of the commutator of W and V. I took the minus sign out. So the algebra, the diffeomorphism, the constraints that generate diffeomorphisms close under Poisson brackets amongst themselves. Another thing that we should check is the Poisson bracket of one of these with a generator of gauge transformations, G of lambda. But this takes a gauge transformation of this, and this is an object which is gauge invariant. It has no free gauge indices, so this is zero. And maybe I should be putting in boxes. Eventually we'll summarize all of these. So, yes, is that?
Yeah. These fields are not dynamic as part of this. And so there is timing that you can do for it.
There's no time yet. I agree. There's nothing is dynamical yet. In particular, nothing is getting us all the three-dimensional slice. What we found is that if you start with initial data on a three-dimensional slice, the G generates ordinary gauge transformations, and the D prime generates diffeomorphisms of the slice. And that's all that's happening so far. That we've shown that there is a consistent, and the algebra is, this is just says that the algebra of the D prime as functions on the phase space is isomorphic to the algebra of vector fields on the manifold. And I could say that and write that in some fancy way, but that's what this is saying. And that up there says that the algebra of the Poisson brackets of the G's is isomorphic to an algebra of the algebra valued functions on the manifold under the brackets in SC2. Okay. So this was the easy but necessary stuff. Okay.
And just to maybe I missed some of your lectures.
So G is a gauge invariant quantity.
G is not a gauge invariant quantity, but an ordinary gauge invariant, but D is.
D is, okay.
Yeah. And D and D prime both are. Okay. Now, the interesting stuff comes with the C. And these are all of the things we've been saying so far as kinematical. The C generates dynamics, as we'll now see. So let's look at, and I start the same way. Let's look at A dot, and I'm going to call this now dot, and you'll see why. AI, which is the Poisson bracket of AAI at X with C snare the net. And that has two terms. There are E's here. So again, the A can only pick up Poisson brackets from here. Okay. And then there's an extra little piece that comes from the E here. And so what happens here is that you pick off one of the E's. The E's have a symmetric row, that is A and B is anti-symmetric and I and J is anti-symmetric, so they're symmetric. So you pick up a term, there's an overall N. You pick up a term which is E, B, J, F, A, B, K, epsilon, I, J, K. And there's a factor of two you get. And then the second term, proportional to the cosmological constant lambda, has three E's in it. Remember, we know from its role back in the Palatini variation principle from Einstein's equations that this is the cosmological constant. And we get a three which factors, which cancels the one third. And we get A plus epsilon ABC, epsilon IJK. Let's see. And let me put the two there, sorry. E, P, J, E, C, K. So that's what A dot is. And while before I talk about what they mean, let's talk about E dot. Similarly, the Poisson bracket of E with C of N. So the only thing that doesn't commute with an E is an A. There are A's in the F. So the cosmological constant is irrelevant. It doesn't come into this. Okay. The A here is under a derivative. So you have to integrate by parts. Then there's a term with two A's, which is going to be nice to us and covariantize the answer. So the answer, and there's a minus sign from integrating by parts, and a minus sign from E with A in that order has a minus sign, so there's an overall plus. You get a D that comes outside, and you have an N and two E's, and it's just a question of tying them up. There's an overall J, so let me call it KL, epsilon JKL, and up to a sign that depends the right sign. So that's how the E evolves.
C, just correct me. C is a transcendent term.
No. No. It's not the transcendent term. If you want to amuse yourself while I'm doing this, okay, there is a beautiful and not very well known, I think so far unpublished, relationship of that to the transcendent form that Chokin Su has been working on. Which I can mention, and maybe I'll mention it a bit later on because there's something very cool about that. Okay. So I'm realizing I'm a little bit. How do I want to explain to you that that is the Einstein equation? Or do I want to just assert that? Let me draw some pictures and assert, because it's a long calculation, and it's something that I think is sort of an optional if you want to check. Since we already have shown that that variational principle is equivalent to the Einstein equations. The question is really just trying to locate and identify. So let me do that. So here is my space-time expressed as my three-manifold cross time, because that's the topological assumption I have to make sense of this slicing. There's some time function t running on the manifold upwards. What it means that it's a time function is that the one form TA, which is the derivative, which is its derivative, satisfies the property that with the metric of space time GAB, TA, TB is minus 1, which means it's timelike. Except that we're doing Euclidean, so you don't have to worry about that for the Euclidean case, but so I don't have to say this twice. That's a requirement which is there for the Lorentzian case. So then these, in the Lorentzian case, these surfaces of constant T are space-like. I'm just telling you something about the geometry of what it means to divide space into space and space-time. The metric GAB of space-time can then be decomposed into a three metric, QAB plus TA TB, so that this is the metric in the tangent space of the spatial slices. And then imagine that I evolve to a next slice or a nearby slice with some delta t. Then there's the time, so let me blow this up. And since I have a metric, I can raise the index and I have a TA. And under the evolution, a field under the evolution by this variational principle, a field at a point here evolves by some diffeomorphism generated by B, and some you go under a diffeomorphism by a certain amount, and you go a certain amount along the time function, we'll call that n, and the evolution takes you from a field here in the space-time picture to a field here in the space-time picture, determined by how much of a diffeomorphism you made in the spatial manifold, and n, which is proportional to the delta t. Now, the identification is that the object n under tilde that I wrote is 1 over square root of the determinant of the 3 metric times that function n, which tells you how far you go in the time along the time vector. And n is called the lapse, and v is called the shift. And the idea is that whilst we're evolving fields in the space-time, we start with fields at some point, we evolve a certain amount along the time vector field, which is the gradient of the time function, and a certain amount by a diffeomorphism. And that's the meaning of the Lagrange multipliers V and N, where N has been corrected by a determinant of the spatial metric to give it density. And I'm not going to derive that for you, but what you can derive showing that is that if you start with any of these objects, so anything at a point x in a spatial manifold at a time t, and you evolve given the vector field that you flow in the manifold and the labs that you go orthogonal to it, that this is the value of the time derivative given by the Einstein equations. And I'm not going to write all that out for you because it's a big, ugly check. But the reason why it has to be true is that I demonstrated to you that this variational principle is equivalent to that variational principle which gives Einstein equations. And you may notice that in the argument here and several other places that I'm hiding, I require that the determinant of the three metric is not zero. If the determinant of the three metric was zero, I couldn't make this map between the space-time Einstein equations and the Hamiltonian formulation, which I commented on before, that everything breaks down if I don't satisfy that condition. Okay, so it's a check, and you're welcome to do it, and the best place to find it described in detail is Ashtekar's books or papers. There are two books, and they don't have it in it. And it's a mess. I mean, it's a long mess to start with these quantities, express them in the language of the four-dimensional metric and the time function, decompose everything everywhere, and check that those are Einstein equations. The things that you're supposed to be amazed about, and that we were amazed about it when we first saw it, is that these are simple polynomial equations. Whereas the Einstein equations are big and ugly and involve inverses of the metric, square roots of determinants of the metric, and so forth. These are nice, simple polynomial equations. And that's really the power of Ashtekar's discovery. Also, these are nice polynomial equations. In case you haven't seen it before, I might as well write it somewhere, but I need a lot of space. Let me put it on one of the blackboards that I'll just hide. If you express the same function in terms of the free metric QAD and its canonical momenta, which I have to yet tell you how to extract that from this information, but even without telling you that, that is pi AD, pi CD, so pi is the density, QAC, QBD, minus, I think it's 1/2, pi AB, let me just call it QAB, the trace of it squared, so that's density weight 2, minus or plus, I don't remember, one is for one signature, and one is for Euclidean, the other is for Lorentzian. But I will say something important, which is that there is a speed of light here. I have been using units where c is equal to 1, but it'll be interesting to know where the speed of light is, and the determinant of q times the Ricci scalar of q, the three-dimensional Ricci scalar of q. And again, it's a check, although then I have a cosmological constant, plus or minus lambda determinant of Q. It's a check to turn this into this. And I'll just give you the translation. The translation is that the A is secretly carrying the information about pi. And let me see if I can get this right. If not, somebody here who knows it will correct me. Given the Q, there's a Christoffel connection on the three manifold. And so I can take the Christoffel connection on the three manifold, gamma ABC. I can use the Frank fields to correct J, E, C, K, epsilon, I, J, K. So if I subtract off from the A the three-dimensional Christoffel connection of three metric, then I'm left with piece, which turns out to be QA B pi C pi B C E C I. So the pi, which is the canonical momentum conjugate to the free metric, is hidden in the piece of the left-handed spin connection, which is not the parallel transport on the manifold, on the spatial manifold. In other words, there's the following fact, which again was not known, and which Sen and Ashtekar discovered, that if I'm in a little space-time, I'm in a little tangent space of the space-time, I parallel transport in the manifold, in the spatial slice, and I have two connections I can parallel transport by. Actually, four connections. I can parallel transport by the three-dimensional Christoffel. I can parallel transport by the space-time connection. I can parallel transport separately by the left and right pieces of the space-time connection, because SO4 is SU2 plus SU2. And the difference between parallel transporting by the left-handed piece of the space-time connection and parallel transporting by just the spatial part, the spatial connection, which comes from the geometry, is linearly related to the canonic momentum for the metric field. And that's another fact that is just, I don't know any way to get that besides a big long check, and I'm not going to do a big long check. But this is, if you like, the dictionary. And it's interesting because it tells you that the left, and then there is this amazing thing that because all of this depends on the three metric, the three-dimensional frame fields, which are in the E, commute with all of this. So the Poisson bracket of the E with the A is just basically the Poisson bracket, like the Poisson bracket of the three metric with its canonical momenta. And when you collapse all the things, you get one. So this is why the left-handed spin connection knows about the time derivative of the three geometry, because it's hidden there. And maybe over the next weeks, I'll think of some clever way. But I don't know. Maybe I'm sure maybe somebody knows a clever way to make the translation to Einstein's equations. But I sweated like a bunch of other people. We did the check because when I wrote this little, it was just a little physical review letter, and it was hard to believe it was true because there was an awful lot of work crunched into it. But the check, if you do the check, it really works. Okay. So basically, I'm trying to intimidate you into believing me that this is the evolution of these objects by the Einstein's equations. Okay. Now, we're not done, because I still have to check, now that I know this, I can check the consistency of the various Poisson brackets. And so let me start with C. So let me start with the easy one. So C, with Gauss's law, is zero because C is a Lie algebra scalar. Okay. All the SU2 indices are tied up So this is an SU2 scalar, so it doesn't transform under gauge transformations. C, with the generator of dismorphisms, I've already argued that any function of E and A with the generator of diffeomorphisms gives me the lead derivative by the vector field as the generator. And so that's true also. LD of C. And you can check that, but I've shown it in general, because I've shown it to the A and I've shown it to the E. Yeah, let me fill in the missing steps. And the Poisson brackets satisfy the Leibniz rule. So if I've shown it for A and E, it's true for any function of A and E. Therefore, by the same argument I gave up here about integrating by parts, if I take the Poisson bracket of C of N, actually, am I using scripts anywhere? Yeah, sort of scripts. C of N with D prime of V, it's the same argument. I multiply, this is the integral of N against C. The N goes along to the right, but I can integrate by parts once I've done the Poisson bracket. And the LV goes on the N. So this is the same as C on the inverse density, which is LV of N. So it shows that what happens is that the argument of C transforms under a diffeomorphism. So C with D prime is C, again, just with a different argument. And so last but not least, I have to do a check of C of M and C of M. And thereby lies the tail. And I think I'm just going to tell you the answer to the calculation and then speak about the tail. Because it's a nice thing that if you're following everything, you ought to be able to check. So let me strongly suggest that you check this along with, see, I've given you all the ingredients because I told you how A and E transform under Poisson brackets. So now you just, it's a nice, it's not two lines, but it's not 10 pages either. It's a nice medium-sized calculation. And the answer is the integral over the spatial manifold of N times the derivative of M minus, and I'm writing the whole thing out for once, M times the derivative of N times QAB, that's the inverse metric, and I should define that somewhere. I have a little bit of space for my dictionary. If I take, the E's are densitized, so if I take two E's and there are conjugate electric fields and I tie them up with the Lie algebra indices, I get something which is the inverse free geometry doubly densitized. What I mean by that is it's the determinant of Q lower with no square root times QAB. So, and the importance of this object is that it's quadratic in the electric fields. So it's the natural thing that you get just by squaring the electric fields. So you get it here, and then you get D. Actually, you don't get D prime, you get D. D A. Actually, let's not just get D prime. Sorry. So it closes that if the commutator of Hamiltonian constraint, we call it, with Hamiltonian constraint, Poisson bracket, is proportional to a generator of diffeomorphisms. But the thing that multiplies it is this one form field. And remember, all these guys have inverse density weights. Times derivatives, times this inverse 3 metric. So, big warning, this is business class, it's not first class. That is, this is a function of the fields. And that's something to watch out for two reasons. And this, what I'm, let me back up a little bit. This is true of the Ashtakar formulation. It's true of the ADM formulation. But it is also true of any Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity or any other diffeomorphism invariant, space-time diffeomorphism invariant theory. And there's a general paper of Heidelboim, I believe, and I'm sorry I don't have the reference here, I think from the early 1970s, in which Heidelboim argues, using the kind of arguments that I make here, that that this is what you get, this is the form of the algebra. And the key thing, and the key scene of the crime, is that, is in this little diagram here, which is why I took the trouble to tell it to you. The point is that in the decomposition, so the question is, okay, the Lagrangian theory, the Lagrangian equations of motion, right, which we wrote down before, are invariant under space-time diffeomorphisms. This is not the algebra of space-time diffeomorphisms. Because the algebra of space-time diffeomorphisms should be, okay, I have a vector field on the space-time, and their algebra is just their commutator. This is not that. The three-dimensional subalgebra of spatial diffeomorphisms is, but this in itself is not. And the reason why it's not is that it knows about the three metric, which means essentially the algebra of gauge transformations knows about the decomposition of the four metric into the three metric and the time function. See, if this was the four metric, then this would have a chance to be four-dimensionally covariant, but this is the three metric, which means that the time function, which tells you who the three slices are, has come into the algebra. And the argument that Heidelboim goes through this carefully and shows that if you started with some transformation, which might be some vector in the space-time, you decompose it into a piece in the three-manifold and orthogonal to the three-manifold, using the decomposition of the four-metric into the three-metric and the time-flow one-form. And because this is necessary to make a Hamiltonian theory, or at least to make a Hamiltonian theory through this method, the algebra of constraints that you have is not the algebra of four-dimensional diffeomorphisms. It has coded into it the 3 plus 1 decomposition, the decomposition of the space-time geometry into a spatial manifold in this geometry, and something orthogonal to it. And because of that, you have here this awkward function Q here, which knows about the 3 geometry and not the space-time geometry. This is not fatal classically. That is, these are Einstein's equations. They're equivalent to Einstein's equations when the metric is non-degenerate. But it's a red flag quantum mechanically, and so I'm waving the flag, because if you try to reproduce this algebra quantum mechanically, you have something that you don't have anywhere else on the board, which is you have the operator will be a constraint, and the coefficient in the algebra is also an operator quantum mechanically. And there'll be issues of ordering between this operator and this operator, and issues of operator products, because there are two operators at the same point. In fact, there are three operators at the same point, because this is really EE. So you're trying to multiply three operators on top of each other at the same point. Okay. So they're ordering operator issues, operator product issues, regularization issues. Okay. And this is a big red flag. And finally, there's a big red flag because the algebra of the Hamiltonian version of the theory is not the same at, see, there's a subtle thing, the gauge group of the Hamiltonian theory has the algebra I've written down. And that algebra is generated by a vector field and a function on the three manifold. Forget the SU2 gauge, because it doesn't come into this. Okay. And they have a certain algebra which makes sense three-dimensionally, which is written everywhere here. Okay. This is not the four-dimensional algebra, which is the gauge, the Lie algebra of the gauge transformations of the four-dimensional theory. So the four-dimensional Euler-Lagrange equations have a gauge invariance which is different from the gauge invariance of the Hamiltonian theory. And this only happens for space-time theories. Because only for space-time theories does the gauge invariance have to do with moving the conditions around that you need to get a Hamiltonian theory in the first place. So,
in a way, it's very hard to construct any sensible observable.
So observables are a problem classically and quantum mechanically anyway. Mm-hmm. Anyway, classically, and I'll come to that. But
it's even more, even worse.
But quantum mechanics, and why I'm raising the red flags, okay, is that from, when was that? 1967, 1968, Bryce DeWitt wrote three papers over a period of several years. The first paper was the Hamiltonian theory, in which he wrote down the equation that John Wheeler popularized that became known as the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. And other people, I'm not saying that Bryce invented the Hamiltonian formulation, other people, particularly Dirac, Peter Bergman, Peter Higgs, have been studying the problem of canonical quantization. So Bryce put the thing in closed form and wrote down what we now call the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which if you don't know what it is, I'll come to it. Then a year or two later, he wrote the first decent paper about half integral quantization of general relativity, in which he got right the issues of gauge fixing and determinants and so forth. And immediately, because of these kinds of issues, he said in the second paper, the path integral is the only way to quantize a diffeomorphism in gradient theory. The Hamiltonian approach is fatally flawed. And from that moment, there have been these two approaches that live uncomfortably with each other till this day. And that's a story that I'll be telling in the next, as we come to it. That is, there's still a very uncomfortable relationship. Even with some progress that's been made, the spin foam models of the path integral, the spin foam versions of the path integral, do not precisely correspond to, as far as we know, to the Hamiltonian evolution in the quantum Hamiltonian formalism. In 3+1 dimensions, in 2+1 dimensions, they have been shown to coincide, but in 3+1, there are subtleties, and they all go back to these, to the fact that there's an operator here. Okay. End of speech. Questions? Okay, so let me just say what we've done, and then we'll take a break. What we've done is started from this form of the variational principle, which we got to last time, and we've worked out the algebra of these constraints, and we've worked out the function of the constraints. And to summarize, we found that Gauss's law does what Gauss's law always does, which is generate internal gauge transformations. What they are is SU2 left transformations. There's the D, which slightly corrected generates diffeomorphisms of the spatial manifold. And there's the C, which has the dynamics in it, that is how things evolve off the spatial manifold, off a spatial slice, as you move your slices. And we found that their algebra closes. So this is, there are no more constraints. This is a complete Hamiltonian formulation. The time derivative of all these constraints is zero, so it's a consistent constrained evolution. Indeed, I haven't proven, but that consistent constrained evolution is equivalent to the Einstein equations. And the only thing which is, say, which is different from ordinary gauge theories is the fact that the algebra of the Hamiltonian gauge transformations is not the space-time diffeomorphisms, but is different in this way. Okay, so why don't we take a break for 15 minutes?